Hello again from the Baltimore Sun. I'm Dan Rodericks, Sun columnist, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 340. It's Friday, January 5th, 2018. This is the weekend episode of our show.
There were a couple of cases last year reported in the U.S. of people who had infections with bacteria that were resistant to every single antibiotic currently on the market in the United States.
That's the familiar voice of Dr. John Smarr, a Roughly Speaking regular contributor, talking about a superbug or pan-resistant bacteria, something that made his infectious disease watch list for 2018. Dr. Smarr is based at Sinai Hospital in Baltimore, and his specialty is infectious diseases. He'll share his list of five diseases he and other doctors and epidemiologists will be thinking and talking about in the new year. Also on the show today, the Maryland General Assembly opens on Wednesday for its annual 90-day session, and Aaron Cox, State House Bureau Chief for the Baltimore Sun, sizes up the major issues facing the legislature, all of them resulting from the actions or inactions of the Republican-controlled Congress. Plus, 2018 is an election year, of course, with Governor Larry Hogan facing re-election and several state legislators facing primary challenges, thickening the state's political plot. Aaron will be joining us in a few minutes. We start the weekend episode of Roughly Speaking with Talia Richman, the Sun's education beat reporter, and the latest crisis in the Baltimore City schools, classrooms without heat during this prolonged cold spell. Officials have received complaints of lack of heating at about 60 of the school system's buildings, and images of students bundled in winter coats have provoked outrage and finger-pointing. Talia, where did this story develop? Where and when did it develop? I was thinking about previous years, and I don't remember the schools being closed down to this extent because of cold weather.
So on Tuesday, it was the students' first day back from winter break, and almost immediately, students, teachers, and parents started posting on social media. There were photos of thermometers in classrooms reading in the 30s and 40s, pictures of young kids bundled up in coats and trying to learn. So while this has been a problem for years, I think that sustained cold weather has really exacerbated the issue in city schools. And people are being outspoken about it, and they're saying, yes, we've had heating problems for years, but this year feels different. And this year we want something to change.
Yeah, and they use social media.
Yeah, I mean, the photos of the kids are going viral. And then also former NFL linebacker Aaron Maben, he works in a city school now, Matthew A. Henson Elementary. And he posted a video of his students talking about how cold they were. And with his platform as a former football player, that really picked up and touched a nerve across the country.
Okay, sustained cold, and how many schools are affected, though, now? What's the best estimate you've received?
So the city school's CEO in a Facebook Live said that they've received complaints this week from roughly 60 schools. So that's about a third of the buildings in their portfolio have had some sort of heating problem.
And students and teachers have actually gone to school with coats on because in some classrooms it was between 30 and 40 degrees.
Yes, yeah, they're saying that they couldn't even feel a difference in some cases between outside and inside.
And the teachers union called for the closing of all the schools until this cold weather passes, is that right?
Yes, they said that until the district can get a handle on the various heating and piping issues, it is inhumane to keep students and teachers in these conditions.
And now you're starting to hear people or see fingers being pointed. I don't know if you can hear fingers being pointed, but people are starting now to put blame for this on various people or things. One thing, for instance, Luke Broadwater, our colleague in the newsroom, had a story today that you worked on with him about the school system in Baltimore having to return millions of dollars in state funding for building repairs, including heating repairs, because they just didn't act on these provisions fast enough. The money was returned to the state because they weren't meeting guidelines. What's the reason for that?
I think there's a lot of different layers to why that's had to happen. But I mean, at the core of it is that so there's other school systems in the state that are much wealthier, and they get to pay money up front to fund repairs to their buildings. And then afterwards, they can go to the state and say, can you reimburse us? But in the city, the city government puts in much less money for repairs, mm-hmm. so then they have to estimate the cost of future projects, and that can lead to these mistakes and eventually the rescinded funds that Luke wrote about.
In some cases, they didn't act fast enough. The money is allocated, but the contracts weren't acted on. It also looked like, Talia, there was some failure to comply with state rules for how projects are carried out.
Yeah, because it comes back to them not being able to forward fund these projects. So they estimate the cost years in advance, and by the time it comes around to actually fulfilling the projects, the cost may have changed or there could have been other delays. But at the end of the day, it's $66 million that did not get used over 8 years, which could have translated into a lot of heating and piping systems and repairs.
Yeah, Luke's story says the money could have funded dozens of new heating systems at schools where the heat is now failing. So the kids are out of school today. It's Friday. The weekend's coming up. I guess it's going to be cold. I didn't see the weather forecast for next week. But what do you expect to happen in the next few days?
Well, the city school CEO, Dr. Sanalisis, has said that her facility staff is working around the clock to make repairs. They don't want to have school closed for many reasons. I mean, they don't want students losing out on instructional time. And then there's the factor of many city students rely on the free meals they get at school, as well as the after-school care. And in many cases, students are safest when they're at school. So they are working around the clock, she says, to make sure that these issues are fixed.
Tell us a little bit about this senior student at Coppin State who started a GoFundMe page.
Yeah, this is a 22-year-old senior at Coppin State University. She's actually an alum of Renaissance Academy. She was their valedictorian in 2013. And her little sister goes to Western High School, which is one of the schools that didn't close in the beginning of the week, but was really, really cold. Her sister actually got sick because of the conditions in the school, she said. And she wanted to raise money, so they're looking to buy heaters, coats, scarves, gloves, anything that schools could use to keep their students warm. As of 10 a.m. on Friday, they've raised almost $45,000. And in talking with them, the organizers of the fundraiser, they said, they really felt like it was on the community to make a change and to come up with an instant implementable fix while people in Annapolis and City Hall are coming up with or attempting to come up with a longer-term mm-hmm. fix that many say would involve millions and millions more dollars.
That senior at Coppin State is Samira Jones, right?
Yes.
Yeah, well, good for her. You're right. I just went to the page while you were talking, Talia. It's $44,889, and the original goal was
$20,000. Yeah.
Yeah, people have really stepped up. Geez, I hope they get this figured out, or we get a break in the weather. All right, Talia, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Talia Richmond is a reporter for The Sun on the Education Beat. You can read her story, the one we mentioned by Luke Broadwater, and the newspaper's editorial on the subject by going to BaltimoreSun.com. A short break for a message, then Aaron Cox joins us from Annapolis, where the opening of the Maryland General Assembly is just a few days away.
Hi, I'm Quinn Kelly, and I host a weekly podcast for the Baltimore Sun called Female Trouble. Each Tuesday, we feature a new long-form conversation with one of the area's most interesting and accomplished women, from public officials and congresswomen to rappers and restaurant owners. You can find Female Trouble on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Find more info at baltimoresun.com/femaletrouble.
The Maryland General Assembly opens on Wednesday for its annual 90-day session, and Aaron Cox, State House Bureau Chief for the Baltimore Sun, joins us now to size up the major issues facing the legislators in this election year. What are you looking at? If you had to write the Sun's main story about the opening of the legislature today, what would you say? What would your lead be, Aaron?
Well, I'm actually doing that today.
Oh, okay.
And so the big issue that is going to take up a lot of oxygen is determining how Maryland should respond to the changes in the federal tax bill. Because Maryland's tax code is coupled to the federal tax code, changes at the federal level obligate state lawmakers here to look at how Maryland levies its taxes. As it stands, because of the changes to the federal level, tax bills for Maryland tax bills, state taxes, will go up for a lot of people. We don't know how much, we don't know for who, but we know because they're coupled together that there is certainly going to be an increase in state revenue. Estimates put it in tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars. So there's going to be a huge debate about opening Maryland's tax code, how to change it, who should benefit, and whether or not anybody should ultimately have to pay higher taxes. And some of the reasons why the Democratic legislature might keep some of that additional windfall is that they have some very expensive things that they really want to do. Among them, the Children's Health Insurance Fund. It's a federal program that provides health insurance to children. Its funding has not been renewed by Congress. Maryland will run out of money around March, and there's about 142,000 children in the state who get health insurance through this program. So the leaders of the legislature say, we've got to do something. We have to have a plan here. And so that's a $100 million price tag. That's a lot of money. That's not money that they just have laying around and they'd have to come up with some way to pay for it.
It's almost breathtaking when you think about a federal program, CHIP, that the government funded. The Republicans in Congress walk away from it. And Maryland, I mean, they're actually seriously talking about picking up that tab.
Or being prepared to pick up the tab on a temporary basis, yeah.
It's still possible that the Republicans will fund CHIP.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But the Maryland Democrats do not want to leave here in April and be unable to do anything else, and not have some sort of safety net.
Right.
That's something that they're just not willing, the leadership at least is just not willing to compromise on. And that's just one of a series of really expensive things that are kind of out there. I mean, they're looking at the Kerwin Commission is looking at millions of dollars in additional school funding. There's a lot of consensus that something needs to be done to help the city and its crime problem. I haven't heard, all the Democrats coalescing around a very specific plan to do one particular thing. And there's also a lot of emphasis on the idea that the legislature has to do something to stabilize the health insurance market, whether it's create kind of an insurance pool for people with really expensive medical bills, or whether it's trying to pass a state-level individual mandate to kind of help stabilize the individual market where premiums are going up pretty high, and the CEO of CareFirst recently warned they might have to back out of Maryland's health exchange because of the uncertainty. So altogether, we're talking about some policies that are crucial to Democrats and have really big price tags, and they'd like to do something about. And at the same time, you have this potential unexpected windfall in higher state taxes brought about by the federal tax bill. So there's going to be this kind of push and pull where you have, a recognized need that we have to readjust the tax bill. That's going to be a huge political messy fight. And we have the governor staking out the position back in December that every penny should be returned to people, that he wants to hold everybody harmless. He doesn't want anybody's taxes to go up.
Hogan used the words, protect Marylanders from the Trump tax reform, the Republican tax overhaul, right? That's what he meant, protect Marylanders.
Yes. I mean, and this is kind of part of Hogan's art form, where he says something where it could be taken to mean a couple different things. What he actually means is he can't do anything about protecting people from having higher federal taxes. That is outside of his realm of control.
Mm-hmm.
But what he can do is make sure that state taxes don't go up as a result. That is something that he can work with the legislature on. And he has taken the philosophical position that the state shouldn't take any extra state tax revenue as a result of this.
That sounds like it would be in conflict with funding the Children's Health Insurance Fund, with the recommendations of the Kerwin Commission, with possibly some costs in stabilizing the health insurance market. It's like a perfect storm of politics in the next 90 days then.
Yes, yes. I mean, and some of these things that seem like a big deal now may evaporate in the next 90 days.
Mm-hmm.
I can't predict what Congress could do, but theoretically they could fund the Children's Health Insurance Program indefinitely, and then a $100 million problem evaporates.
It's also an election year, and I thought the rule of thumb for legislative sessions in election years was, you know, keep it low, keep it fairly quiet, don't do anything too controversial, don't raise taxes.
Right. And one of the reasons why they do that is because you have people working at cross purposes. You know, there are several members of the Senate who are running for higher office. There are several members of the Senate who are incumbent senators who are being challenged by members of their own party in the House. They're facing primary challenges. There's several people running for county executive. There's people running for Congress. There's people running for all sorts of offices. And they need to go back to their constituencies with a record in the General Assembly that they can be proud of. And so they don't, you know, take up anything controversial. But they don't really have a choice this year.
So because it's an election year, we'll talk a little politics here. And, you know, we're always curious about this governor who remains pretty popular in polls that are taken in Maryland, Larry Hogan, an incumbent Republican running for re-election. And then we have 8 Democrats lined up to challenge him. There'll be one winner in that primary in June. So one of the questions that lingers is, you know, does Trump affect Hogan? Hogan has distanced himself from Trump on occasion when he's had to. He did a wise job of that, a lot of people say, during the election in 2016. And here he is trying to protect Marylanders from the consequences from the tax overhaul that the president signed.
So the Democratic Party first kind of tried to do this Hogan is Trump strategy, which didn't really seem to get a lot of traction. And now they've kind of shifted the nuance a little bit, and they've been talking about how we need somebody who's going to stand up to Trump more than Hogan. And the Democratic Party and the 7 Democrats running for the nomination really kind of say that Larry Hogan hasn't done enough. From my perspective, it seems more likely what's going to affect Hogan is who shows up to vote. Right, because his coalition, he needs his Republican base, he needs some independents, and he needs some crossover Democrats, just because of the electorate in Maryland. More than half are Democrats, about a quarter are Republican, about a quarter are independents. Mm-hmm. So to get more than 50%, Larry Hogan's got to get all of his Republicans, a lot of independents, and some Democrats. And if you have what you had in Virginia and elsewhere with this huge, huge wave of Democratic turnout, that's how Trump would really hurt Larry Hogan. Less that people associate them with each other or think that, you know, that Larry Hogan is like Donald Trump and therefore they don't want to vote for him. More that people who would be inclined to vote for a Democrat anyway are a lot more motivated to get out and vote and show up on Election Day.
That's a really interesting question about the 2018 midterms. What happens in November if there's a big turnout in Maryland, just Democrats and independents saying these Republicans have just driven us crazy, Trump's driving us crazy, we're just going to vote for any Democrat we can find, right?
Exactly.
I mean that could happen.
Right, it could happen. And, you know, this is, you know, the climate in 2018 is much different than 2014, but if you look at the Democratic turnout in 2014, among the reasons that Larry Hogan won the election, was very successful, is because a lot of Democrats simply stayed home. Mm-hmm. And if that doesn't happen again, even though he's a lot more popular, even though he might have more supporters than he did 4 years ago, the idea that a lot more Democrats would be showing up at the polls doesn't weigh favorably for Larry Hogan.
Aaron, thanks very much.
Always my pleasure.
Aaron Cox is the Baltimore Sun State House Bureau Chief. She writes about Maryland politics and state government. Look for her complete story on the 2018 General Assembly this weekend online and in the print edition of The Sun on Sunday.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rogics is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at 6080 Falls Road, located at the intersection of Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. More information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.
Now, Dr. John Smarr, an infectious disease specialist based at Sinai Hospital in Baltimore and a Roughly Speaking contributor, he presents his list of diseases to watch for in 2018, including a pan-resistant bacteria or superbug, unaffected by multiple antibiotics. So, John, Dr. Smarr, Happy New Year.
Dan, Happy New Year to you, too.
Here we are in the frozen part of the year. I mean, it's really frozen. It's cold, and you're not thinking about mosquitoes and insect-borne viruses and germs and bacteria. You think everything's frozen, but what kind of diseases do you expect the spring to bring?
The first one is, of course, influenza. And so that's the one that's around right now. And the issue is that, number one, the incidence is going up, like we're really ramping up into flu season. And number two, there's concerns about, again, how effective is the vaccine in terms of it actually helping and preventing the flu?
I got my shot, Doc.
Excellent. You anticipated my question.
Yes, I got my shot this year.
Excellent. But the important thing is that the flu virus that's going around, again, we're in a situation where it looks like the vaccine does not perfectly match up with what that virus is in terms of how well it works, because we have to figure out months in advance, like predicting the weather, what viruses are going to be around to pick the specific vaccine, because it takes 6 months for the process to make the vaccine to occur. And in that time, as the virus is floating around through the community, it can actually mutate. It can change as it goes from person to person.
What a challenge that is. So is it a bit of a dice toss?
It is a bit of a dice toss, and that's part of the problem. And a big issue this time around is that the current circulating type is H3N2, which is something that we see. It's one of the main circulating ones that causes problems every year. But this particular one looks like it may have subtly changed more than some of the other types of flu that we've seen. And so maybe the vaccine isn't as much of a match. The other challenge, and it's something that we haven't overcome in terms of how we make flu vaccines, is we make them in eggs, in chicken eggs, which is funny when you think about the avian influenza, like the chickens are trying to kill us at the same time as that's how we, it's this old technology, but that's still how most
that's
people
how it's
make
done
it.
Still.
That's
huh?
how it's done. And so when you're making the vaccine inside of eggs, it can actually sometimes change a little bit in there too. And so it's very imprecise. And what this highlights is that it's very hard. We haven't actually come up with a good one vaccine to treat all the flu, the so-called universal flu vaccine. And that's something that people are very focused on from a research standpoint. And the problem is that the influenza virus, you can think of it as like a ball with a bunch of pieces that are sticking out. And so what a vaccine does is it stimulates your body to make antibodies, which essentially stick to those pieces on the outside and help then get the virus out of your system. Mm-hmm. So the stuff that changes is all those bits on the outside, and the stuff that stays the same is the pieces that are on the inside. That's harder for antibodies to get to. And so if there was a way that we could get a vaccine
to penetrate,
that could penetrate, or that could specifically stick somehow, to stimulate antibodies that could stick somehow to the pieces that really aren't changed among all the types of the flu, that's the big problem. And so that's a
but
big deal.
But you're better off with the shot, with the vaccine, than without.
Oh, absolutely. I mean,
And this goes for everybody, all ages, pretty much?
Yeah. Everybody six and up should just get it.
All right.
Six months and up.
6 months and up. Yeah. And it's not too late to get it here in January.
And even though we're talking about more flu activity, it's still the right thing to do. Most of the time when you get the flu, you're fine, or you just feel sick. But the big problem is there are people younger, older, medical problems who it can be more serious or potentially fatal for. And it's not just about you. It's about who you might inadvertently transmit it to.
All right, that's number one. That's
number
a perennial,
one.
Right?
Oh, yeah. But it was worth talking about.
What's number two on your list?
So number two on my list is good old Zika, because it's the time of the year where people are starting to plan their summer travel. And as you mentioned before, we'll be dealing with mosquitoes. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing about Zika is that 2016 was the big Zika year, when it was around big time. And then last year, it was still around in the United States, and it really has tapered off, though. So when you look at the numbers that the CDC has, they would say that there have been something like 5,600 cases in the U.S. since the whole Zika thing started. But last year, there were only 385 cases.
And restricted to a certain region of the country still?
Right. And so it was Brownsville, Texas, and a couple areas in Miami-Dade County. It's interesting because as of, I guess, about 7 or 8 months ago, the CDC lifted any sort of a special alert for traveling to those areas. But they still urge everyone to be cautious, because who knows, it may still be in the mosquito population. And the other piece is that, so in Maryland, we only had 10 cases. in the last year. And there's also less Zika, say, in South America, because remember, with the big issue was Brazil, where it really bloomed over the course of several years. Mm. And the big deal is that there is that actually it's much down there, too. And so there are questions about why that is. Probably more people are immune to it. And so that could be one reason. Or the virus, as it's going through the population, maybe there's been a change, like similar we're talking about influenza. So hopefully it's something that we're not going to have to really worry about in this coming year, but it's still something. Mosquito precautions are critical, especially for pregnant women, especially if you're going to an area where there's a lot of risk or potential
the
risk.
South, Central America, the Caribbean.
Right. And okay. And the CDC would still urge mindfulness if you're going to sort of the southern area of Texas or you're going to the areas of Florida that were also previously affected.
Number three on the SMAR list.
Ebola. Because people are still worried about that. And essentially, Ebola, it's died off in terms of anything in Africa. And this is good news. I'm saying this like I'm exasperated with that fact. But since 2016, since a few months into 2016, there were still some sporadic cases that came up. But at the end of the day, right now, there really hasn't been any activity. And the key thing is that we all heard many months ago talking about the vaccines that were being developed for Ebola.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. And is that still happening?
And that's still happening. It's in process. As far as I can tell, it's not out yet as a thing that's been finalized that you can get. But the promising piece was the fact that the last big trial they did on one of the vaccines showed that it was actually 100%
effective. Wow.
Which is pretty amazing. And that's obviously the opposite of the flu vaccine situation.
Wow.
So really it's all about the CDC still has, along with the WHO, lots of active work in the affected areas of Africa, because the biggest thing is, you know, it happened once before. Maybe that was the perfect storm of circumstances and it would never happen to that degree again, but you can't actually predict that. Mm. So it's still something to be mindful of, and hopefully this year we'll see sort of the final big, we've got the Ebola vaccine and figuring out who that goes to. Like the U.S. government is going to buy millions of doses of that to stockpile it, but then trying to figure out who are the right people to vaccinate, because you can't vaccinate everyone,
right?
Because of cost and sort of risk, but who are the right people in terms of travel? Will it be sort of like yellow fever vaccines in the sense of if you go to a certain area of Africa, you will be required
West
to
Africa,
have
yeah, for instance,
West Africa, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay, so we'll go to number four now. John, what's that?
So number four is actually pan-resistant bacteria.
PRB.
PRB. This is a brand new thing that we're making up in terms of that acronym, because there are other acronyms that are used.
But pan-resistant bacteria.
Right. And so there were a couple of cases last year reported in the U.S. of people who had infections with bacteria that were resistant to every single antibiotic currently on the market in the United States. Now, granted, that's only been two people. But that being said, the issue is that this is something we've been worried about for a long time. And of course, it's a common thing in the current healthcare environment to run across folks who have very resistant bacteria. But the idea that even your last line antibiotics, there's one that's called colistin or polymyxin, and that was the big deal with these. This last line antibiotic is incredibly toxic in terms of potential side effects. It was actually one of the first antibiotics ever discovered, but we found out that if you put it into your body, it can have major issues with your kidneys, major neurological issues, a whole host of side effects.
So how is it applied?
So it's something that you do intravenously, but we decided that it is so toxic that it really is the last line thing. However,
and that didn't work in this case.
And so in this case, these two cases, they were both resistant to that antibiotic.
What was the infection like? Was it a lung infection? Bacteria? What was it?
It was, for both cases, it was bacteria that the person became septic. So wherever their first source of the infection was, it had spread into their bloodstream and throughout their entire body.
Wow.
So this colistin polymyxin stuff, if that name polymyxin sounds familiar to anyone, it's because we did figure out that if it doesn't go inside your body, it works really well. So if you over-the-counter get triple antibiotic cream, that's one of the things that's in that cream. So it works totally fine on your body, on the skin, for skin infections, because you're not absorbing it. But it's when it's given through an IV that it can cause major problems. But the upshot is that we're living in this era now where we're starting to see this sort of nightmare scenario coming true. And drug companies are fast-tracking antibiotic development to make new ones. There was a new antibiotic that just came out, deflufloxacin, and its big deal is it's been approved for skin infections, and specifically it can actually kill MRSA, because one of the things we are trying to find is other drugs that can work against MRSA. But the challenge with a lot of antibiotics when they're new is that they can potentially have side effects or have similar things. So these class of antibiotics, as some people probably know, has been popularly associated, which is true, in the news with more and more case reports of tendon rupture. Like someone's taking the antibiotic and let's say they're even going for a walk, let alone a run, and they can rupture their Achilles tendon.
Wow.
And so there's a host of other side effects that can go with this. So every time we get a new antibiotic, it's into the mix with side effects
and a new
well.
Bacteria,
right.
So that's number four. What's number five on your list?
So number five. So I've got number five, and then there's a bonus. So number five is just the point that we don't know. Like you think about Zika, you think about Ebola, and these were things we knew about years before they became major issues. Mm-hmm. And so there's very likely emerging things that we don't know about, and we're not going to talk politics, but all of us in the infectious diseases epidemiology community are very concerned about making sure that from a government standpoint, state, federal, that we have resources or we have money allocated for the general idea that we may need to swiftly respond to a new thing that is scary and can make people very sick. The last bonus one is HIV. It's declining a little bit in terms of its incidence of new cases, but still out there. I still encourage everyone get tested routinely if you have any risk. There's this medicine, Truvada is the brand name, that's been approved for pre-exposure prophylaxis. If you know that you might be in a risky situation, to take beforehand to prevent HIV. So that's just another one that is perpetually always there.
I'm glad you mentioned it. Is it standard in blood tests when you go for a physical, your annual physical? Is it?
In the state of Maryland, it still requires consent, a verbal consent. There's not a consent form you need to fill out. So it still needs to be part of the discussion. It's not an automatic, I can just do it without telling someone. But it is something that I encourage both physicians and any of us when we're patients to get screened for if we have any risk factors whatsoever.
Well, John, thank you. There's a lot to look forward to there.
Indeed, there is, Dan. So indeed, there is. Thank you.
Glad you have your eyes on it. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Dr. John Smarr is an infectious disease specialist based at Sinai Hospital in Baltimore and a regular contributor to Roughly Speaking. That's our show for the weekend. For producers Steve Early and Quinn Kelly, I'm Dan Rodericks. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking. Please review us on iTunes if you get a chance. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you again soon.